it's the last Saturday of the month, and therefore it's a mishmash, but stick with us. You're going to learn some things. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheep, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policies. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And Barry, it's been kind of fun with you on Facebook tonight. That's right, folks. We have a Facebook presence, and we've been having some interesting chats with people over the impending elections. Let's just say that Barry and I do not have a mainstream view of how things are working in the upcoming presidential cycle, and it shows in our posts and how we deal with people who say silly things on the internet. One of my favorite things, Barry, is that little cartoon. You can see the wife's little balloon off in the corner. It says, "Honey, come to bed." Mm-hmm. And he says, "I can't. Someone on the internet is wrong."
Yeah, I've seen that one before. And ladies and gentlemen, we try to be winsome in all that we do, but sometimes, no matter how good you try, typing out your thoughts on a forum such as Facebook or on blog postings or other things just isn't the pure sight that it ought to be. And oftentimes you cannot bring across those things that you're saying in the way or the heart motive or the tone of your voice. And tone of voice is a big thing. And sometimes those can be taken out of context. And that's usually when you end up getting people typing in all caps, which means that they're screaming and yelling.
They're screaming, yeah.
And that's a shorthand online for screaming and yelling, as if you type out and start writing in all caps. Then you end up having people basically shut down, and they don't understand that you're just asking them questions to see where their logic leads. And that's what we try to do. And that's what we try to do on this program. So if you get mad at us and you yell at the radio, well, we're sorry. We don't mean to have that kind of tone with you. But we want to make sure that we think through these things. The Bible says that we are to study to show ourselves approved. And it is talking about how we use the Word of God. But we also need to study to show ourselves approved in how we live in our lives in society and in culture and in the areas in which we engage, which includes our politics, ladies and gentlemen. We have to be able to think and understand fallacies, which we hope on this program we help you with, as we do programs every once in a while on how to detect logical fallacies. You have to have a consistent worldview, a biblical worldview that's based upon God's absolute truth, so that you're not thinking from what is considered a morally relativistic or rationalistic perspective. Or as some would say online, that they're being realists. Now, Chuck, I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but every time I hear somebody saying, "I'm just being a realist," it means they've stopped thinking.
Yeah.
It means that you've taken them to a point in their own logic that they have no defense anymore, and so that's the only card they have left to play. I'm being a realist, which the implication is, when you're asking them questions, you're living in a fantasy. Well, no, that fantasy world is called logic. It's called absolute truth. It's called biblical worldview, and it's called application of those said same things to the culture around us. Now, if that means I'm not being a realist, well, thank you, Lord, is all I can say.
Yes.
Because if I were being a realist, that means that I would be going along with what the world wants, which is denial of God, anything goes, elevate yourself to a position of deity, and whatever makes you feel good, you do it. Or whatever assuages your conscience, you do it. Or whatever is most profitable for you, i.e. money, wealth, you do it. Or whatever you think will get over on the other guy, you do it. I'm sorry, I'm not that kind of a realist, ladies and gentlemen, and hopefully none of you are either. I hope I'm talking to an entire world audience of a lot of people who are living in the perfection fantasy. Because, you know, it's nice here, the water's warm, come on in.
Come on in, yeah. Well, one thing that we can do on the air that we can't do when we type it out, we can show our sarcasm on the air. I mean, you and I speak sarcastically all the time. I've been criticized for being sarcastic, and I've had people tell me it's unbiblical, and I always tell them to go read the book of Job.
Yes.
Because God is actually being very humorously sarcastic. If you read it, he's also being critically sarcastic. Did you paint the stripes on the zebra? He asks all the questions, and Job gets the point. At the end, he gets the point. And that's kind of the reason that I use sarcasm. It's, look, let's kind of look at this from a different angle. And I tend to be a kind of a person who, this is the way I attempt to approach questions where there's maybe something deeper behind it. I try to carry an argument out to its logical absurdity. And by that I mean you find the place where when you take the example further out, beyond, possibly beyond the actual view that you can see in front of you, you see where it breaks down. And you see where it becomes ridiculous. That's carrying it out to its logical absurdity. And that very often makes people angry because it shows them that they're not necessarily thinking all the way through something. Now, we're all guilty from time to time of not thinking through an issue. I've been caught with my pants down on certain things by people who've asked me questions where I didn't think my position through all the way. And generally, I hope I'm gracious enough to say, you know, I never thought of that. So let me think about that, and then we'll get back to you on this. Well, I'm finding that there are fewer and fewer people that do that, and more people who just basically immediately go over to ad hominem attack once you get to their base view and show them that it's going to break down over time. Your argument is not going to carry through. Very often people get mad because you've now questioned our thought process. Well, Barry, you and I both adhere to a method of Christian apology known as presuppositional thinking.
Yes.
And the way presuppositional thinking works is you ask people questions to work back to their base assumptions. In other words, presuppositions are things, these are the ideas that you have in your head when you start. It's all the assumptions that you make when you go to make an argument. So what you do is you ask questions to get at those base assumptions. And very often we find that when we ask the correct probing questions, we get back to people's base assumptions. And we find this in all people from all walks of life. And believe me, I've had in my own church, I've had people ask me presuppositional questions where I had to go home and open up the Bible and think about it to see if I was in the right place. And believe me, in many cases, I was not. So this is not something that I use with any kind of lack of care. I know that very often when I use that tactic that people are going to end up angry with me. And you can see that particular methodology at work in Acts 17, where Paul goes up to the Areopagus. And at the end of that discourse, there are people that simply poo-poo him and walk away and say, you know, he's drunk or he's a fool. But there are other people who say, we'll hear you again on this.
Yes.
Those are the people who are thinking, who actually have realized that he's asking me and telling me things that are getting at something that I didn't realize was there, and I wasn't thinking in that way. In other words, they said, I'll have to think about that and get back with you. I want to hear more about this. And that's what very often what we try to do. Now, sometimes people come out, and when you're able to master this, and it's really not that hard. Greg Bonson teaches how to do it in his book, Always Ready.
Yes.
There are numerous courses out there that teach, Greg Bonson wrote another great book called Pushing the Antithesis that I need to get a copy of. I've only read it by borrowing it. I'd rather own a copy. But what you find out is once you start using this technique, you have to use it kind of carefully because people end up mad at you.
then there can be a tendency, and ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about this because it's important to think through. There can be a tendency when you are pressing someone to the core of what they believe and asking very direct questions about not the surface level things. You know, we all can talk about the weather and sports all day long, and we can even talk about politics and religion all day long, but when we start talking about why do you believe what you believe, who is your source of ultimate authority, and how does that play out logically when you apply it to situations, then you're really getting into somebody's way of life. It's like opening an onion up. You're laying open the layers of their core being. And so you have to be very careful with that, not to be, shall we say, like a bull in a china shop where you're right and they're wrong, because, Chuck, as you pointed out, sometimes somebody can ask a presuppositional question of our thinking and be like, let me go think about that and find out whether or not you're holding to correct presuppositions, or if there are certain errors or wrong thoughts that because we have so many inputs, whether it's from our parents, from churches, from pastors, from teachers, from the media, books, television, from our acquaintances, our associates, our bosses, there are so many inputs that we have to be careful that when we go back to the pure unadulterated Word of God, that we have to say all of these other things have to subjugate themselves to the Word of God. And regardless if so-and-so thinks such-and-such, if the Bible says, thus saith the Lord, and the answer is no, And that's
That's right.
And that's what we got to get back to. But then when you go to share with somebody else and you ask them and they're still holding on to so-and-so said such-and-such, well, what does God think about that? Do you believe in God? Well, yeah, of course. Well, do you believe that he spoke clearly in his word? Do you believe the word is true? Do you believe it's without error? Do you believe that God is who he says he is? Then what's your proper response? That really gets into somebody's mind and their heart and their belief system and their values. And you have to be careful, but it is a loving thing to do because we are to, as believers, to work with each other to put on the mind of Christ and to renew our minds daily and to tear down false suppositions and high things that exalt themselves against the knowledge of God. We're called to do that, ladies and gentlemen, as Christians. And so sometimes it can get a little ugly, but we have to remember who we serve.
And occasionally, sometimes, you know, people come out and will just basically lower their head and dive into you as if you're the bullfighter and they're the bull and they're just going to stick you. And we all have egos. And occasionally we can let it get out of control. But sometimes, especially when politics is involved, Barry, things can go south really, really fast.
Yes, it can.
Especially when you use that presuppositional method to find out what kind of, are you using a consistent thinking or are you using some kind of double-mindedness? In other words, compartmentalizing things. If you recall, when Bill Clinton was president, people talked about how what an amazing guy he was because he could compartmentalize all these things. He could compartmentalize his personal trouble over here, but do this and that and another thing with the foreign policy and the economy. Well, folks, it's a dangerous thing. Remember, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. You can't be double-minded about things. You can't compartmentalize things. You have to look at things as a whole. Now, does that mean that you necessarily come through and force your way through and say anybody who doesn't have the same opinion I have is completely wrong? Well, you might think that. Otherwise, you wouldn't hold that opinion. If you thought somebody was right and your own opinion was wrong, you would have a different opinion. But the fact is that we all have to work with people who have differing opinions and have differing ways. Now, you can respect a person who has a good argument and is consistent in their thought with the things that they believe. But let's face it, it's very difficult to deal with someone who says, this is what I believe, I have an opinion, and this is the way I'm going to do it, and buzz off. Well, that's not really a consistent way of thinking. That's just simply randomly picking something you're going to do and not necessarily having a good idea of why you do it. You just do it because you want to do it. It feels good. Therefore, that's what you're going to do. And that's the kind of thing we run into, Barry. And we also run into people who have traditions. I think everybody's got traditions in their background. They've got things that they do because it's been done that way forever. I've been accused of being a traditionalist. And I said, yeah, I am a traditionalist when the traditions have firm backing. When traditions are not firmly backed, then I'm ready to abandon them. I don't need to hold on to anything just because it's old. I collect old radios, but I collect old radios because they still receive radio signals. It's fun. And I rebuild them, and I can look at something that's as old as my mother or my grandparents and say, wow, this is cool. It worked then. It still works. And I made it work again. But I also am aware that a nice modern radio can do the same thing, operate on batteries, and cut out a lot of the noise that I get in my old radio sets, you know. So I'm not so traditionalist that I can't see that things that are modern and buck tradition aren't all necessarily bad. So when tradition works its way into the way we think, that's fine. But when we hold on to it, then basically we're being reactionary. When we hold on to it in view of all the evidence to the contrary, we're being bigoted and reactionary. And hopefully we're examining ourselves to try not to do that.
We have
life is a life is supposed to be a constant reexamination. And some of us do that pretty well and some of us don't. And sometimes I slip up on that but I work on it. That's how you keep your mind young. You basically constantly reevaluate and you think about things, and hopefully that will continue until the day they throw dirt in my face.
We renew our mind daily with the word.
That's it.
That's right. We renew our mind daily with the word. You know, and ladies and gentlemen, we segued on this for a little while because we just thought it was important to chat about this for a little bit. We want to make sure that whenever you hear things on our program, we are trying to come and bring a biblical viewpoint, a consistent viewpoint, and a constitutional viewpoint. And we're trying to do so in a winsome way. Possibly there may be times when we may sound a little harsh, or I would hope not condemning, but sometimes you just see things and you know what's going on and you have to treat it with the level of seriousness that it really has. And sometimes that's not very serious at all. So that's the reason why we sometimes poke a little fun on the program. And
yeah. And
we're going to poke some more fun and being serious, too. On yesterday's program, we talked at quite a bit of length about a ruling by the United States District Court for the Southern District of Ohio against the University of Cincinnati and some of their political speech codes that they had on campus. And Chuck, there were a couple more things we really wanted to get into, but in the limitations of a 15-minute program, we couldn't quite get to. But that's the reason why we're kind of wandering through this again today, just to talk a little bit more about some of those other points that we wanted to bring up. So I'm going to turn that over to you and let you run with it.
Okay, well, one of the things that I noticed in the 1851 Center's report on this is something that nobody else apparently picked up. And that is that, now, Barry and I discussed this a little bit off air. Our attorney general is Mike DeWine, and he's a former U.S. senator who was basically thrown out on his ear for being, well, let's face it, being wishy-washy while he was a United States senator. He was not particularly attempted to appeal to conservatives, but the fact is that he was what was part of what was called the Gang of 14, who was basically soft on tax increases, was willing to vote for virtually any judge who would come before the United States Senate appointed by liberals, and as liberal as they can be, he would always vote in favor of that person for their confirmation.
And was undermining then-President Bush's judicial nominees, it being basically a centrist moderate. That was part of the Gang of 14, but I think, you know, part of the legacy of the Gang of 14 led to the, well, John Roberts, which led to the Obamacare decision that just came out recently that had many people except us scratching their heads in disbelief
right.
that John Roberts could do that because he was such a good conservative. But former Senator DeWine lost his office, Chuck, because of one vote specifically, and that was he voted in favor of federal hate crimes laws.
Right.
You know, creating a classification of quote-unquote hate crimes for crimes that were committed surreptitiously because the person's sexual orientation. And I don't think he's ever lived down that vote or denied that vote or repented for that vote. But in 2010, the voters of Ohio saw fit to elevate him back to a statewide office, and so he is now the Attorney General of the state of Ohio.
Well, he was shoved down the throats of the Republicans by the state party apparatus. That should shock no one if you know anything about the Ohio Republican Party. It's as absolutely liberal as it can be. The chairman was his cousin, Kevin DeWine.
Or nephew. I don't actually know if it was cousin or nephew. I'm not sure
nephew.
What that
I think you're right. It's his nephew, I think. I think you're right. But apparently his nephew doesn't like him very much. But nonetheless, he kept it in the family. And they're both liberal Republicans. And basically the Delaware County prosecutor who was leading for that race was brushed aside. And Dave Yost, and now he's the, Secretary of State?
State auditor.
No, he's state auditor. Yeah, so they gave him a consolation prize. They let him run for state auditor because he was leading in that race, and he was probably going
to win. And opened the door. They moved him over to state auditor, knocking out a movement conservative state representative by the name of Seth Morgan, who many of our listeners might know, who had announced and was filing for that race before Mr. Yost and the Republican Party decided that that was the race where he would best sit while they put Mr. DeWine in as their candidate for Attorney General.
And I'll be quite honest, I actually expected Mike DeWine to use where he sits now to try to retake his old seat. But instead, that went to Josh Mandel. The nod from the party went to Josh Mandel for a number of reasons, which we won't get into because that's not the focus of this program. But let's just be clear that Mike DeWine is no flaming conservative by any stretch of the imagination. On this case of the University of Cincinnati and the free speech zones, the Attorney General has a, shall we say, a fiduciary responsibility to aid state agencies, to give them legal advice in lawsuits.
And that includes state-funded institutions like the University of Cincinnati as well.
Yeah, and by a fiduciary responsibility, a lot of people think automatically in terms of economics when you think fiduciary. That's not what it means. It means they have a responsibility as a representative of a given group or person, that they have the duty to act in the best interests of that particular thing, that they have a fiduciary responsibility to. That's what a fiduciary is. It's a
person who stands in security of somebody else's interests.
Bingo.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Very, very well done. Thank you. And, okay, so that being said, we have the University of Cincinnati that is clearly in violation of the United States Constitution by the creation of these quote-unquote free speech zones, which really aren't free speech zones at all. They're basically a quiet corner of the campus, and I believe in the University of Cincinnati it was a parking lot.
Yes.
Out on the outskirts of campus someplace.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
And as we spoke of yesterday, any place that isn't a free speech zone means that it is an anti-free speech zone. There is no way around this. This is not a gray area. Things are either black or white in this area. That's either free speech or there is no free speech. Okay. What does Mike DeWine do? Does Mike DeWine go to the university and say, hey guys, this is a bad plan? As a fiduciary, he has the responsibility. If they come to him, he should say, you know, you need to back down on this one and walk away from it and give them their free speech area, you know, let them have free speech on campus. No, Mike DeWine instead authorizes $200,000 in state funds to a private law firm, Crabb Brown, who turned out was a campaign contributor to Mr. DeWine, to defend the clearly unconstitutional University of Cincinnati policy. That comes from the 1851 Center story, which we'll put a link up to. Okay, why did Mike DeWine do this, Barry? Why didn't Mike DeWine go to the University of Cincinnati and say, and their attorneys, and say, look, capitulate, fall on your sword, do the right thing, just back off it. This is a bad rule, you shouldn't be doing it, and it's gonna create trouble. Instead, he spent $200,000 in state money.
Okay, well, there are multiple reasons for that, Chuck, some of which are fairly clear and some of which could depends on what happened inside the office. Number one, the University of Cincinnati has its own attorneys as well. They don't just rely on the state. And oftentimes, they don't ask for the state attorney general to render an opinion or weigh in. They just come and say, we got to defend this and we need X number of dollars. Can we do that? Or they would ask the attorney general if their internal attorneys obviously are needing some extra firepower to appoint what's called a special counsel. Now, special counsel work at the Attorney General's office, ladies and gentlemen, is an area, now, you know, it was pointed out in that news release from the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, Maurice Thompson's organization, who were the attorneys who won the case for the Young Americans for Liberty chapter Cincinnati at UC, pointed out in that press release the connection of Crabb Brown Law Firm and being a campaign contributor of Mike DeWine. Well, Chuck, that's kind of how the political game works. A lot of special counsel work through the Attorney General's office go to firms that are political supporters of the person who holds the office. And it happened when Rich Cordray was the Attorney General, a lot of special counsel work went to firms who were connected with the Democratic Party. Now that Mike DeWine is the Attorney General, I think you can take a look and there's listings of who gets special counsel work across the state, and there are lots, and it's millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars, not just this $200,000 to Crabb Brown. It's multiple millions of dollars that are spent annually on special counsel work from the Attorney General's office. And those are oftentimes now go to firms that are primarily considered to be Republican supporters or Republican firms or Republican donors. So that's part of that whole situation. And my guess is that, honestly, DeWine's office, probably he personally never even saw this. An assistant attorney general somewhere down in the bowels of the division just put a request in to have it paid out, and it was approved somewhere in their bursar's office, and the money went out to the law firm, and they just went ahead with it. Now, had DeWine actually looked at this, I think hopefully he would have immediately said, "Oh, this is just ridiculous. Hey guys, why are you doing this?" But you know, by that point, Chuck, it's far too late. The suit had already been put out there. Back in June, a preliminary injunction had gone up against the university from the Southern District Court. But let's stop and think about this, folks. It had to have gone probably to a trial court first, and then was sent to the district court on appeal. Now, I'm not sure, maybe, and since I'm not an attorney, and nor do I play one on the radio, I don't know if this was a case that could immediately be filed it would have been filed at the district court level. Who am I kidding? This is federal. This isn't state. There wouldn't be a trial court, so this is the first court of appeal. There would have been a notice. So the AG had an opportunity, a significant opportunity, to be able to look at this and go to the university and say, you can't do this. And that's perhaps what he did, because between June and August, the university totally changed their speech codes and rewrote them. Whether there's no indication of that there was any assistance from the state attorney general's office on that at all, but you would hope that the state attorney general, instead of just handing taxpayer dollars to firms that are associated with being donors to his campaign, was actually paying enough attention that maybe there were some conversations going on and he was advising them during that time period, you guys are going to lose this case. Here's what you need to do.
Yeah, now I'm going to ask you a question again, where we're going to go back a step and talk about fiduciary responsibility. To whom is Mr. DeWine primarily fiduciarily responsible?
Well, as the attorney, ultimately he's fiduciarily responsible to the people of Ohio.
Bingo.
That's bar none. Now, let me give you the political answer. Politically, he's fiduciary responsible to the state and its agencies and what do they call it? When it's not like a – because the University of Cincinnati is not a state school, but it accepts state money. There's a term for that, and I'm drawing a blank on it right now, but – I'll think about it later, ladies and gentlemen. Just bear with me. Because they have an interest, the state has an interest, a financial interest and otherwise, in the University of Cincinnati, then that is the Attorney General's main client, is the state of Ohio, and its assignees. That's it. The institutions and its assignees.
Okay, well, this picture is more complex than it looks, but he has a primary and a secondary responsibility. Now, yeah, I'm still trying to figure out why he wasted $200,000. Okay, yeah, if some flunky down the chain made the decision. But here's what I want to know. You know, there was when Harry Truman was president, he had a little sign on his desk. And what did it say?
The buck stops
here.
The buck stops here.
Now, it seems to me that what's being played here is the Bill Clinton game, which is the buck never got here. The joke was that the Clinton had that sign on his desk. Now, of course, he didn't. But that was the excuse. The buck never got here. And I want to know if that little functionary down the chain got brought into the office and got a chewing out or was handed his walking papers. And I'll guarantee you the answer is no, because undoubtedly he's some promising young attorney who just made a mistake. If, in fact, the attorney general was willing to bet to admit that a mistake was made at all. Maybe I'm making too big a deal out of this, Barry, but this is the reason why bad things happen, is because people who are sitting in these offices, whom we elect to sometimes, shall we say, well, they're there to guard our best interests, and instead they guard the best interests of themselves and the people that they have to deal with in the legislature, fundraising to get votes, the party, that kind of thing. This is why we're in trouble, because stuff like this is allowed to happen and no one really questions it and no one holds the boss's feet to the fire. Maybe I'm being too harsh on this, but the fact is the question ought to be asked. And of course, no reporter at the Dispatch, in any of the local television outlets, nobody in Cincinnati is going to ask the question, because, well, gosh, you know, that's, why does that matter? Well, it matters a lot.
It does, very much so.
And that's one of those questions that gets at the base presupposition.
Yes, it does. It goes right to the heart of it.
And that's the problem, Barry. We're not thinking that way. We have taken on a way of thinking of things that says, well, they're doing the best job that they can.
Wait, we're being realists again?
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to bring that back up since we talked about it earlier, because that's when we stop thinking about it from a biblical constitutional standpoint. We start thinking about it as, well, everybody else does it, or, well, they're just doing the best they can do, or, well, once you start getting a lot of wells, you fall into them.
Well, that's correct. That's exactly right. And you fall in a deep one. Now, what has happened? I think that this thing at the University of Cincinnati, and it's not an isolated incident. In fact, one of these stories, either out of the 1851 Center or the Ohio Liberty Coalition, something came up about that as well, basically talks about the fact that this is not something that's necessarily isolated in Ohio, that a lot of universities have adopted this methodology. Now, what should happen from this case? Those universities should immediately look at this and say, okay, maybe we better rethink this. Maybe we better redraft our free speech codes. Will they do that? No, I have a feeling that what they'd rather do is retrench, hire a bunch of lawyers, and see if they can't beat it in an appeals court.
Well, honestly, that's probably a modus operandi, but the university basically cried uncle by rewriting their codes before the permanent injunction came down.
Cincinnati did, but I'm hearing there's the same thing going on. There's some of this going on at Ohio State. There's some of it at Kent State. There are other universities around Ohio. I think Miami does it, although Miami, I think, is a private school.
Yeah, but you know what, Chuck? I think this is the time now for the state's attorney general, Mr. DeWine, to go around to the other state-supported schools in Ohio and say, okay, guys, it's time to review your speech codes. And we're going to show you this case, and we're going to say that you're probably better off to be proactive rather than responsive to a lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly. Don't expect us to spend $200,000 more bucks on your case. It will be very interesting to see what the final outcome of this is, because, again, we go back to looking at this, and the same people who were screaming for free speech rioting, taking over buildings, demanding free tuition, now run the university system. And I can tell you that tuition in 1965 was a fraction of what it is today, and it is not just proportional to the inflation rate. The cost of a college education is rising and has been for the last 50 years at a rate far greater than the rate of inflation, which is why you now have people that are saying, well, we're not going to send our kids to college. We're going to have them take up a trade.
Absolutely.
The bang for the buck is in the trade. I mean, you come out of Ohio State University with a degree in underwater basket weaving, what are you going to do with it? You can maybe get a job. I knew a guy once who had a degree. He had a master's degree in the classics. You know what he did? He drove a UPS yep. truck. Now, he actually made pretty good money driving a UPS truck, but he didn't need a master's in the classics to be able to do it.
No, he did not, but that's okay.
Yeah, and so he's now probably one of the most educated UPS drivers around, but maybe not. Now, I have a degree that I use a lot, but I know a lot of people that I went to college with who are doing many, many different things with their degree. They got a degree, but they're not doing what they trained in. So this is one of those things, Barry, that we look at it and we say, okay, are we thinking through everything that we're doing, or are we holding to tradition? People go to college because their parents want them to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Or they want to go to college. And a lot of times kids want to go to college because they want to party. They don't necessarily want to work.
Yeah, well, that too is true.
That has become part of the culture, is to go to college and act like an idiot for 4 years. And speaking as someone who did his share of idiocy while he was in college. And I was an older student, so that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it. But I would love to ask this question. I'd love to get someone in the media to go to Mike DeWine and say, okay, why? If you're fiduciarily responsible to the people of Ohio, why did you attempt to defend a bad free speech code? Now, speaking from experience, Mike DeWine will prevaricate, he'll hem-haw, it'll be some nonsensical answer, and he'll claim that his real fiduciary responsibilities to those institutions and that kind of thing. Well, that's nonsense, and you need to listen to it critically when he does it. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up today's program.
Well, you know, Chuck, there are a lot of other things that we're needing to talk about today, and one of them, it seems, is a perennial issue and really becomes, shall we say, inflamed with rhetoric during a busy campaign season, especially one when the presidency is on the line, and that's the issue of abortion. As our listeners, if you've paid any attention to the media in the last week or two, you've heard a lot about the issue, mainly, Chuck, talking of the comments, U.S. Senate candidate from Missouri, Todd Akin, and his comments that were broadcast far and wide and have called for hue and cry, especially from Republican Party leadership nationally, for him to step down from his U.S. Senate race against incumbent U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri. And I don't necessarily want to reiterate and rehash, because we've talked about this a little bit earlier, about Akin's comments. But the point is that the issue itself is one that inflates a lot of rhetoric. Let's just be quite honest with it. There's a lot of sound and fury, and it signifies very little in the way of real actual policy changes. The thing going right now, however, as people are listening to this program, going into next week and then into the week after in the beginning of September, are the Republican and the Democratic National Convention. That's the party for the party boys, where they can get a go and hoot and holler and hear a bunch of speeches from people who weren't picked as a vice presidential candidate or who may be on the short list for somebody's future presidential candidacy. And all the thing that they're doing right now, Chuck, and I know that this is both the Republican and the Democratic Party, is they're working on the party platform. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a party platform is a statement of beliefs and principles, really. And honestly, that's really what it's gotten down to. It's almost as effective as the U.S. Constitution, because oftentimes, right after they get done writing the party platforms, they spend the next 4 years totally ignoring what they've said in their party platform they swore to uphold as good Republicans or good Democrats. And this year's no exception, is it, Chuck? It's interesting because there was a lot of furor recently in Republican circles coming off the Todd Akin issue about how the Republicans were going to be writing their party platform and that they may abandon things like traditional marriage and pro-life position. Well, that didn't happen. According to my understanding, those particular pieces were still left in the party platform, even though you have some moderates and pro-choicers who are on the platform committee. But I want to turn our attention more to what I think is a bigger anomaly than a pro-choicer on the Republican Party platform committee and it coming out pro-life. And that is to go over to the Democrat Party Platform Committee and look at what they're up to. Because out of this, and this was an article that came out of CNSNews.com by Pete Wynn. It's titled "StuPac: Pro-Life Dems Plan to Counter Planned Parenthood and NARAL at Democratic Convention." Well, Chuck, for those of our listeners who may have thought, well, wait a minute, that name sounded kind of familiar. The StuPac we're talking about is former congressional representative Bart StuPac from Michigan. Now, he's famous, or infamous, I guess is the best word, Chuck, for the StuPac Amendment, which during the debates over Obamacare, Bart StuPac was a pro-life Democrat in Congress who wanted an amendment to from abortions being authorized or paid for under the Obamacare plan. Well, that was wrestled with and back and forth, and everybody was talking about the StuPac Amendment. Well, when push came to shove, Chuck, the StuPac Amendment didn't end up in the final version of Obamacare, but Bart StuPac voted in favor of Obamacare.
Anyway, yeah, that's right.
So now former representative, because after that election, that year, he stepped down and chose not to run again. So now he is a delegate to the Democrat National Convention, which is going to be held in Charlotte in September. And he and a number of other pro-life Democrats, they have a pact, Chuck, called Democrats for Life America. Basically, they're crying that the Democratic Party, now get this, needs to be more diverse and inclusive. I thought that was the Democrat Party's mantra. Was
exactly.
And inclusiveness. But obviously, it doesn't extend to anybody who holds that an unborn child is a human being and deserves protections.
Well, they may have some inkling about that, but it doesn't really matter because the other stuff is more important. Life is not the primary part of their platform activities. It's a secondary issue. They're committed to it, but they're not so committed to it that they'll actually not vote for legislation when it doesn't have that in there.
Well,
and yeah. Let's talk about the StuPac amendment. It wouldn't have done anything anyway. If you'll recall, it was put in by executive order.
Yes, it was.
Which means that it really isn't in there at all. All it requires is another executive order, and out it comes.
Well, that's the reason why I said it never actually got into the bill, because it didn't. It was done as an executive order outside of it. And I guess that was good enough for Bart StuPac so that his conscience was assuaged enough that he could vote for Obamacare so that we could force sterilize young girls.
Yeah, exactly. This basically is, I'd love to say that there's a difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party on the life issue, but there isn't. The fact that there's a pro-life plank in the Republican Party is meaningless because the Republicans routinely build ultra-conservative platforms and then go about ignoring them.
Ignoring them wholesale. And for our listeners, scream and yell at us, you know, I don't paint too broad of a brush because there are many who are in both parties, both the Republican and the Democratic Party, who would be staunchly pro-life, Chuck. It's just that it's the party leadership in both parties at the national level who are ultimately calling the shots and calling the tune when it comes to how, not how the platform is written per se, although they do that too, but how the party discipline is enforced against any member of the party or candidate or office holder who strays from the party platform. Now, here's where the big difference between the two parties show up, Chuck. In the Democratic Party, you stray from the Democratic Party platform, you're in outer Siberia. Okay, you are definitely going to get ostracized. You're going to probably, there's going to be calls for your resignation and calls for your head. Now, on the Republican side, if you stray from the party platform, nobody cares. It's a collective on. Well, we're being realistic. Or the situation is such that, well, the other guy's worse. So, you know, we won't focus on the fact that our guy is violating the platform that we swear to stand by when we become party members of the Republican Party and we take off for the Republicans, but they don't care. Well, except on the fact, and obviously we go back to Todd Akin, that if you actually go out publicly and state something that actually does adhere to the party platform, all of a sudden you're not a team player anymore and you should go away. Now, the same thing happened in 2006 with Ken Blackwell here in Ohio, who was calling his fellow Republicans to adhere to the Republican Party platform. And they didn't like hearing that, Chuck, especially last year.
Blackwell had a number of issues with party insiders who basically pulled the plug on him and voted for Strickland and said so publicly.
Yeah, absolutely. And
the main problem that they had with Blackwell was that he actually was adhering to the Republican Party platform, unlike his opponents in that race, who basically came out and had various things. And, well, I'm a conservative, but... You know, they were all for public-private partnerships, although Blackwell had a little issue with he wanted to adopt this public-private partnership selling the turnpike thing, and I think that, frankly, that's turning out to be disastrous.
Well, and every politician has some issues, and this is not a Ken Blackwell love fest or critique session, but basically what we're getting at is the parties has discipline within the party. They can take people out of, if they're, like, say, in Congress. Now, if you go against leadership, well, then you can lose your committee spots or your chairmanships, or you don't get the plum assignments, or you don't get endorsed for your reelection or for your election race if you're not towing the party lines. But here we've got Bart Stupak, and he's trying to get the Democratic Party to embrace pro-lifers in the party, at the same time that NARAL's president, Nancy Keenan, is on the platform committee writing the platform for the Democratic Party. So I'm not sure. This is almost as big of a challenge to Bart Stupak as his amendment was. And I'm wondering if they just basically tell him, well, we'll write a little codicil out here that we'll all talk about. Will that satisfy you?
Well, okay. Let's give a moment. Just for a moment, let's give our experience in party politics.
Sure.
You and I were a member of a third party, and we won't mention them here just because I don't want to give them any advertisement. What I learned was that this party, which claimed to be engaged in principle, not politics, turned out to be politics, but no principle. Because we had a very stiff pro-life plank in our platform. And when you and I were involved in efforts to actually discipline state parties who were ignoring that pro-life plank, it was we who were thrown out of the party. And in fact, the party's motto was the only 100% pro-life political party. And after we were thrown out, the motto suddenly became the most pro-life political party.
Yeah, they couldn't go with 100% because it just didn't register anymore.
So basically what we discovered was that what this third party was filled with was little fish Republicans who were tired of swimming in the big pond of Republicanism and had decided to come over to a third party and be the big fish in a small pond. And they brought their tactics with them. And claiming to be, you know, because they were anti-income tax and that kind of thing, therefore, they really didn't care about the life plank. The party was full of people who didn't care about the life plank, and then there were people that were very pro-life that didn't care all that much. Their issue was secondary with the life issue. So you had this dichotomy of people, and what both parties are trying to do is plow some kind of a, or at least it was that they were trying to plow some kind of a middle ground to the right or to the left of that issue. The Democrats have basically chucked it all and said, no, we want to kill as many babies as we can, and we want to do it as rapidly and as cheaply as possible. And there's a story in Breitbart that talks about how the platform is being changed. And basically, presidential infanticide, abortion platform does not exclude partial birth abortion. Well, of course it doesn't. There's a lot of money to be made in partial birth abortion. It's a very expensive procedure because it's almost virtually always late term near birth. Well, that means the complications are high. And as we saw with this week with the Haskell Clinic near Dayton, the doctor who runs that has basically almost killed several women. And it turns out that most of these physicians that do abortions because they're not very good doctors. I mean, they would
challenge that assertion, but the point is, I think you have a point there.
Statistically, they're not very good because how many women actually die from the quote unquote safe, legal, and rare procedure? They either die or they're maimed permanently and can't have children. It's a high statistic. Let's put it that way. One of the things that goes on with the performance of abortion, and nobody wants to talk about that, at least on the pro-abortion side. Breitbart says, here's something the corrupt media is covering up about Obama's abortion extremism, Obama's actions as recently as 2008. And we all know that Obama was the one vote to not ban partial birth abortion in Illinois. I mean, that's simply is undeniable. He was the one vote. Obama's 2008 endorsement of late-term abortion bans also appeared to be in conflict with his support for the Freedom of Choice Act. In 2007, Obama co-sponsored the FOCA, which would strike down restrictions on abortion at the state and federal level. The bill stated that all abortion must be legal before the viability, whatever that means, for any reason that abortions must be legal until birth if a woman's health is at risk. FOCA does not contain a definition of health, therefore anything an abortionist says is related to health is sufficient, according to Douglas Johnson, legislative director of the National Right to Life Committee. A state would not be able to adopt any limiting definition, for example, defining health to exclude emotional distress. And Barry, you and I have talked about this many, many times.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, she's going to have a nervous breakdown, therefore we have to let her have an abortion. Because that would be to narrow and infringe on the federally guaranteed right which FOCA would establish. The entire purpose of FOCA is to prohibit any narrowing of the federally guaranteed right, for example, by requiring parental notification or by refusing to fund abortions. Now, as the article points out, there's a culture of life and a culture of death, and the man leading the charge in the culture of death is the same man who just took over our entire healthcare system. Ouch.
Well, there's nothing like saying it like it is.
Yeah, I mean, let's pull no punches here.
But the point is, Chuck, this is the same party with the same leadership that Rep. Bart Stupak is going to go to Charlotte and try to convince to be more inclusive of those who are alive. Does the name Don Quixote mean anything to anybody out there? Because that's exactly what this is. This is tilting at windmills. And as a matter of fact, and this is the point I wanted to bring up, what they're there, they're delegates to the convention, and there's another former rep, Kathy Dalkemper from Pennsylvania, who are going to have a panel discussion at the Democratic National Convention titled, "Can You Be Pro-Life and a Pro-Choice Party?" Well, Chuck, I'm sorry, but honestly, that's the wrong question to ask, because the answer is yes. You can be pro-life in a pro-choice party. You just are going to be frustrated completely, and you're never going to get your voice heard, and you're never going to move ahead in the party structure. The proper question to ask is, can the pro-choice party accept and change to accommodate pro-life members? And we all know what the answer to that one is, and the reason why they didn't ask the question, and that is absolutely not. Now, the director of Dem for Life of America, Kristen Day, has basically made the point clear. Well, this is necessary because the platform has totally shut out pro-life viewpoints. Okay, Chuck, how many times do you have to say it before somebody realizes it? The Democratic Party is about taking innocent human life.
Of course it is. I mean,
that is a sacrament to their party, that the abortion in all circumstances. I mean, if they were honest with each other, abortion in all circumstances, for whatever reason, would be where the Democratic Party would be, regardless of the supposedly 1/3 of Democrats pro-life. Now, and I know a number of pro-life Democrats. Most of them are Catholic, and most of them are very pro-life. Most of them are also Democrats who, and I don't know what their voting habits are, but we know that during the 2008 election, many pro-life Catholics voted for Barack Obama.
And Barry, here's the problem. There are a lot of pro-life Republicans who are going to vote for Mitt Romney, and guess what? He's real wishy-washy on the life issue.
Oh, and has been, and has a record on it. And I know we can hear many of our friends screaming, but we got to get rid of Obama. Okay, fine. You know, yeah, we don't disagree. You got to get rid of Obama. But the point is that, and honestly, we're in this situation now, Charles, because we're always in this situation, and that is that the machinations that lead up to having really very little in the way of choices between the two major party candidates president is because the party apparatus wants to filter out, just like with Todd Akin. If you stand very strongly on these conservative issues, that's too controversial for us, and we got to run to the middle in order to win this election, so therefore we pick a centrist. That's just basic party politics, ladies and gentlemen. And let's not kid ourselves that, oh, you know, grand, you know, wonderful conservatives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People run as conservatives. The old adage in politics, and it's true, Charles, is that you run as hard as you can to the right to get the nomination. And then as soon as you've got it, you run as hard as you can back to the middle in order to try to win the election.
Paul Ryan is already moving away from a staunch pro-life position. If you've heard any of the rhetoric lately, he's already talking about, yes, except in cases of rape and incest. Well, just for a minute, because we're out of time, but let's talk about that rape and incest exception. Everybody thinks that that's a rational and a sort of compassionate position. It is not, because basically what you're doing is applying the death penalty to one of the victims.
And that's exactly where Todd Akin should have gone with his comments, was, why should we penalize the victim for somebody else's crime?
And that's what happened to Akin. Basically, he tried to avoid answering the question the way it should have been answered, and that is, why are we applying the death penalty to one of the victims, and that's the child? The children of rape and incest are just as alive as, and just as much a separate entity, just as much a separate new life as the children of regular, you know, happy sexual activity.
Marital conception.
marital conception, and they have as much of a right to live as full life as God has ordained for them as anyone else. And the idea that somehow they are a result of a crime and therefore can simply be broomed out just simply doesn't make any sense. Now, with that, unfortunately, we're out of time, Barry. I'm going to have trouble cutting this down already, so join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies. Or, I'm sorry, on Monday for another Principles and Policies.